Feminist historian Jill Kirk-Conway was the first woman president of Smith College. That's a long way from the sheep station in New South Wales, Australia, where she grew up. In 1960, when she was 25, Conway left Australia for graduate school in the United States. Conway recounts her childhood in the outback and the years leading up to her departure for the U.S. in her memoir, The Road from Kurrain. Kurrain was the name of her father's 30,000-acre ranch. I wanted to have a sense of the place where Conway was from, so I asked her to describe the landscape.
Oh, yes, with pleasure. If you look at a map of Australia and draw a line 500 miles due west of Sydney, you come to an area that is just empty. If it's a map that shows climate, it will show less than 10 inches annual rainfall. It is totally devoid of trees, except where there's a submerged stream that produces a few straggly clumps of trees. Absolutely flat, very beautiful in colours, wonderful scarlet soil, and usually grass that is burnt to a beautiful gold and silver colour by the heat of the sun, and an enormous sky.
So you grew up in a very isolated setting.
Totally. Our next-door neighbours were, about 50 miles away on one side about 20 miles another and 10 or 12 in another direction.
Your first schooling was through a correspondence course.
Yes, it was. My mother thought I could do two years in one, and she told the correspondence school that, but they thought there were two children on the place, so they sent the first lesson of the first grade and the first lesson of the second grade. And continued in installments all the way through the year. It wasn't clear to me that it was work of a different degree of difficulty, so we didn't know until the end of the year.
I love what you say about studying alone in isolation, that you were introduced to study as a leisure time activity. It sounds like you never really grew to dislike education in the way that so many children who go to schools do.
Well, I think that's true. You know, so much time is taken in school with getting children to sit down at the same time or stand up at the same time or concentrate on the same thing. And for me, it was sheer pleasure. I was doing hard physical labor on the sheep station, and I worked at that 4 days a week. And on the fifth day, on Friday, I got to sit down and do my school, and it was such a treat because I'd be given my own pot of tea, and my Friday was a baking day, so there would be great smells of fresh baked scones and cookies coming from the kitchen, and I felt totally indulged, and I've never felt about learning any other way.
Were you sure that you would go to college?
It was very clear in my family, because my mother was such a feminist, that I would. And interestingly, the stereotypes of gender worked in my favor in my family, because it was expected that my brothers would probably not go to university, and would, since our father was a rancher, that they would take up life on the land too, and that meant that they would begin that right after school.
You went to the University of Sydney first, yes?
Yes, I did.
And then you thought about what to do next. You decided you didn't want to go to school in England because you'd feel like a colonial there. You applied to Harvard and started living in the United States. Did you find that there were more opportunities for women?
Oh, goodness, yes. Well, I arrived at the Harvard Graduate School. I lived in the graduate residence where there were several hundred other women all getting PhDs and all enormously bright and interesting people drawn from all over the world. And I found a director of my graduate studies who regularly told his students that the contribution of women to American intellectual life was as important as men's, and handed out lists of women whose lives needed to be studied and whose intellectual histories needed to be written and so forth. That was just a new world for me.
What set you in the direction of being a college administrator, first a vice president at the University of Toronto, then the first woman president at Smith?
Well, I was a woman who had the good fortune, I think, to be born at the right time. I was just finished my PhD and beginning life as a professional historian just at the point when there was an enormous expansion of higher education in the United States and Canada. And I went to Canada with my husband, who was taking part in planning and building a new university in Toronto. And myself joined the history department at the University of Toronto. And in the process, I suddenly discovered one day that although I had joined the history department at the University of Toronto with a group of young men, all trained in American doctoral programs like me, I was the only one who wasn't being promoted, and I found that I was also being quite severely discriminated against in my salary. And so I just got in a rage and went and confronted the department chairman and the dean with this information. And they very quickly rectified the situation. But when I was finished, I realized that there were loads of other women faculty who had parents or children to support and were in much more jeopardy protesting such things than I. So I began organizing the women faculty. And before I knew it, I was in a leadership role that I just stumbled into. And very shortly thereafter, there was a change in the university administration, and I sort of had to put up or shut up, and so I accepted a position as one of the university vice presidents. And so I sort of backed into it and then found out I really loved it.
Mm-hmm. You spent 10 years as the president of Smith College.
Yes.
The first woman president of Smith College, which is
right.
a women's school. Now that women are admitted to top colleges around the country, do you think that there still is a need for women's colleges?
Oh, absolutely. First of all, you have to remember that women's colleges in this country are probably the only ones that have a consistent record of having co-educational faculties. They're usually roughly 50-50, and most of the institutions that are co-educational in their student bodies have a long way to go in terms of equal recruitment of women faculty and administrators. One learns to take one's place as an intellect and a politically active person in a society in which all the roles of leadership are open to women. And once you learn that and internalize it, you're never phased again. And then there's an enormous advantage to a woman from moving from late adolescence to young adulthood in a setting where there are very strong female models around her, so that she doesn't experience her working self and her generative self as in any conflict, but the one affirming the other. And intellectually, women's colleges are still utopias in which women's experience is taken seriously and not seen as somehow or other to be assimilated to men's or deviant if it doesn't match.
Did you ever go through days where you'd think to yourself, how did I end up the president of a college? After all, I started in this correspondence school?
Often. I must say, I think that I was very fortunate in that early education because it gave me a very strong sense that I could educate myself, learn any task that I set out on. And so I wasn't fazed by all the new skills I had to learn at different stages in life, but certainly I was often amused by that.
In your memoir, you describe a bit of the Bush ethic.
Yes.
This is living in the Bush, not George Bush, I should say, for anybody just tuning in.
Yes.
And you said that the Bush ethic made a virtue out of loneliness and hardship, and the idea was when disaster strikes, what matters is unflinching courage, the refusal to consider despair. Does that ethic in any way inform your attitude now?
Well, it does and it doesn't. I find that it is just ingrained in me to stiffen up and become stoic when faced with a challenge or real hardship or tragedy. But on the other hand, intellectually, I don't accept those stoic values. So I've taught myself to be emotionally much freer. But the training in just straightening the back and digging in the heels is very deep, and yeah, I still have it.
When was the last time you returned to Karain, the area where you grew up in?
I took my husband there about 4 years ago. He was absolutely overwhelmed by the isolation and the emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
The house where I grew up is now empty. The ranch is part of a much larger property. So that it was both very lovely to see that landscape again, and very poignant to see this world my parents had built now in process of decay.
In the process of decay?
Yes, because the house isn't lived in any longer, and the garden, which I describe in my book, is gone. But as I also say, the land renews itself and is as beautiful as ever.
Well, I want to thank you very much for telling us a little bit about your life. Thank you.
A pleasure.